This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
And welcome to New Books in History, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and my usual role on the network is as the host of New Books in Genocide Studies. Occasionally, however, I pinch hit for other channels on the podcast, and today I'm doing so for New Books in History. My guest on today's show is James Wright. Jim is the author of 6 books, professor emeritus of history and a former president of Dartmouth College, and a longtime advocate on behalf of Americans veterans. Today we're going to discuss his new book, Enduring Vietnam. I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk about the book with him. So with that, Jim, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in History.
I'm delighted to be with you, Kelly.
Jim, we always start out the same way, and so I'd like to invite you just to say a little bit about yourself and how you ended up being a professor of history and a president at a university or a college.
Sure. I was born in a small middle western town, Galena, Illinois. It's a Mississippi River town, and my father had been in World War II, and I grew up in the 1950s, and it was a time when everyone really expected to go into the service, at least back in this mining town. And in 1957, when I graduated from high school, five of us, 4 classmates and I, joined the Marines together. And I thought it would put off for a few years my going to work in the local mines. And I came back and decided I did want to go to college after all. And once I started, I've never stopped. But I did work in the mines as well, so I managed not to avoid that turn. I received a PhD in American history at the University of Wisconsin in 1969, and I came to Dartmouth that year to teach history, and I've been here now. Next year it'll be 50 years I've been on the campus. I'm retired, but I'm still involved and still interested in history.
So I was thinking about this as I was composing the intro, because is how to describe Vietnam. And my first thought was George Herring's old title of America's Longest War, and that's by some measures true, by others not. I thought a little bit about the usual title for Korea, American's Forgotten War, and that's mostly driven by my sense of what my students know about Vietnam. I'm wondering, given your interest in Vietnam, when you think about Vietnam, when you refer to it in your head, how do you describe that war? Do you have some short, pithy way? And why did you decide to write about it?
Well, there are several questions, related questions there. Mm. Vietnam is not America's forgotten war. By any measurement, it's not forgotten. On the other hand, I'm not certain how well known it is. And I would make a distinction there. Everyone knows about the Vietnam War and the 1960s. They may not know much about it. And I'm not certain in the 1960s that most people in this country knew much about it. And I wrote a book that was published in 2012, Those Who Have Borne the Battle, which is a history of America's wars and those who fought them. I was really trying to look at who fights our wars and how do we treat them when they come home. And in that book, I did have a chapter on the Korean War, but I had one on the Vietnam War. And I was struck by working through that again and realizing, given my interest in how does each generation experience a war, what do they remember about it, that how little most people really did know about Vietnam. People still make references to it. They talk about avoiding Vietnam, avoiding another Vietnam, and that's always a prudent and good thing to try to do. But I think we have to understand what it was. And my focus, though, was less on the diplomacy, even though I do talk about that some, and I'm not very, very favorable toward those who took us to Vietnam. But it's not a book about that. It really is about that generation that served in Vietnam. It's the baby boomers generation. I've been visiting military hospitals in 2005 to visit with veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and I found it very important to go bed to bed and talk to kids, and I decided that I wanted to tell their story, but I also, in the course of doing this, realized that the story of the Vietnam generation had not been told. I've always been frustrated by the idea of that people use to talk about sending in troops of boots on the ground. I wrote an op-ed a few years ago about this, saying that we're not talking about shoe leather. We're talking about flesh and blood. Those who will send the young to war have to realize that there are consequences of that, and that some will not come home. And we're not talking about little boots prancing around. We're talking about our sons and our daughters. And I just was struck in working through this with the current generation, how little we really knew the Vietnam generation and who they were. You know, Lieutenant William Kelly, who had headed the Army unit of My Lai that massacred the Vietnamese, he may well have been the most remembered soldier who served in Vietnam. There were no public heroes that came out of the war. So I decided I wanted to get into this. You know, in the play Hamilton, Eliza Hamilton, the widow of Alexander Hamilton, sings, "Who lives, who dies, who tells their story?" And war, no matter how we try to cast it, war is finally a test of who lives and who dies. It's a contest to see who survives and who does not. And those on the ground are the ones that have to, are involved in determining that. And the rest of us can be involved in who tells their stories. So I set out to tell the story of the generation that fought in Vietnam, really the baby boomer generation, who they were and what their experience was. I didn't try to moralize about that experience. I'm certainly honest about some of the terrible things that happened in Vietnam. That's not my purpose. I just want to tell the story of who these kids were, and they were kids who went to Vietnam, what their experience was serving there, and what their experience was when they came home. And that's basically what this book is about, an American generation and its war.
Yeah, it's a wonderful approach. But before, of course, we get to Vietnam, there's another generation, right? The group of people who fought World War II, who end up in leadership positions, either in the middle leadership or in Congress or positions of national leadership. I wonder what that generation, what kind of common set of perceptions about the world and America's place in it that generation brought to their effort to figure out what to do about Vietnam in the 50s and early 60s?
Yeah, I talk about this surely in the book, and I talk about President Kennedy, and you know, when he was inaugurated in 1961, he talked about the torch of liberty being passed to a new generation, and he talks about his generation, the American, the World War II generation, and as I point out in the book, that yes, they did take the torch of liberty, but they passed it on rather quickly to their children. And they're the ones who ended up in the jungles of Vietnam. The World War II generation, Kennedy's generation, Lyndon Johnson's generation, Richard Nixon's generation, there was a legitimate concern, to be sure, about Stalin and the Soviet Union. There was a perception, certainly in the 40s and 50s, of not just if there would be World War III, but when it would come, and we were determined to be ready for that. We were determined after the experience of World War II, where we thought that we had been too deferential to Adolf Hitler, had allowed this dictator, this aggressive dictator, to develop political strength, to develop military strength, to begin rolling over smaller states in Europe, and we did nothing. That we could not continue to allow this to happen. It became the Munich analogy, the idea of when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain had signed an agreement with Hitler to allow him in 1938 to occupy parts of Europe with the promise that he wouldn't do any more, and of course he immediately did more. And so the idea of the Munich analogy was this commitment that we no longer would stand still and allow a dictator to develop. It was almost a schoolyard lesson of standing up to the bully in the schoolyard. If you don't stand up to the bully, he'll continue to bully you. If you don't stand up to the dictator and to the aggressive dictator, he will continue to move his military and take over places. And so this was the mindset. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Jack Kennedy would make references to Munich, and they said their generation had learned. We were involved in a massive international struggle with the Soviet Union, and then when the communists took over the government of China with the Chinese communists, so there was a genuine threat. It became exaggerated, perhaps, by the 50s, but certainly by Joe McCarthy and others who were concerned about communists lurking around every corner and selling us out. And so there is this greater paranoia. And so the World War II generation brought up their kids in the 50s, and perhaps your parents or your family. It was the duck and cover time. Duck and cover were drills that we had in schools. We had them in my small town in the Middle West, for heaven's sakes. The idea that be ready to get under your desk in a hurry if there's a Soviet nuclear attack, and it's going to come. So we grew up with a sense that we lived in a scary, threatening world, and it was a scary and a threatening world if sometimes the nature of the threat was exaggerated. And we also were brought up with a sense of obligation, of duty, of a need to serve. And we were the children, I was, of the World War II generation. Our fathers had gone off to war when they were asked to go to war, and that was the responsibility of every generation. And so the kids of the 50s grew up in this world, and it's not surprising that so many of them ended up in the early years of the war willingly standing up and saying, yes, I'll serve. You know, we have an image of the 1960s, of this baby boomer generation decade, of the generation of wonderful music and free love and protest against the war. You know, about 40% of the men of that generation served in the military. A pretty significant percentage of them did. Many who served during the war were volunteers. They agreed to go. They didn't wait for a draft to go. Now, it's you know, many of the, quote, volunteers may have been draft-induced. Indeed, even when I joined the Marines before the Vietnam War in 1957, it was certainly in a world where we knew that there was a draft and we could be drafted at some point, so why not pick the time we would go, and why not pick the branch of service in which we would serve? And there was surely some of this, and many of the people who enlisted by the middle 60s probably were draft-induced in the sense that they thought, okay, I'm going to have to go anyway, I'll go. But I interviewed 160 people for this book, Billy, and I always asked them, why did you go? Why did you decide to go? And the number of them who answered this by talking about growing up in the 50s, who talked about the threat of communism and their responsibility, who talked about their father serving in World War II, and said, I could not go. My dad went. And now is my turn to go. And so that's how this generation first came into Vietnam. Now, you know, the Vietnam is a war, and the nature and the understanding of this war changed quite rapidly. And by the late 60s, the time that I think is more part of the image, the folklore of that generation, more and more people were protesting the war, and there were some who were insisting they would not go, and many did not go, although it's important to remember that more names of the young men of that generation are on the Vietnam Memorial Wall than went to Canada or went to prison for refusing to go to war. And I do talk about those. I did interview some of those who didn't go, who protested the war, who went to prison. And then they have remarkably strong and courageous stories to tell as well. But my friend, and so I'm surely not dismissive of them or of what they stood for and what they represented, because when they talked about the war as being ill-conceived, and when they talked about it being immoral in conduct, when they talked about other things by the late 60s, they were largely right after all. But I'm talking about those who did go to war, and who they were and what their experience was. And that's what this book was about. That's what I was about. That's what I was trying to do.
So what would it have meant for America to have won in Vietnam? And why does America have such a hard time achieving that?
Well, I think we had, I'm not, you know, the sort of counter to fact, what would it have meant? We won is an interesting question, and we can both speculate. We can all speculate on that. I do think that we had difficulty winning for several reasons. One is that we really, Vietnam sort of became a surrogate place for a broader skirmish with international communism. And we thought this was the place, Southeast Asia, where we had to make our stand. At first, Jack Kennedy had really talked about Laos as the place where we'd make our stand against communist aggression. And Vietnam became that place. So it was surely that's where the war was fought, and that's what the war nominally was about. But it also was about a much larger global conflict that played out there, and it was certainly necessary to describe the rationale in as about Vietnam and about defending a democracy there. And I think that's where the situation became less solid and more rocky, more complicated. It was hard to talk about the government there as being a democracy. They surely were not communists, and that was we in a world that was polar. You either were a communist, or if you weren't, you were a democracy. And we had some interesting allies in the 1950s following that sort of view of the world. And we really went into Vietnam with an idea not to have a, quote, military victory. Lyndon Johnson he sent the first ground troops in March of 1965, and that's when it really became an American war. And he did talk about to the troops about hanging that old coonskin on the wall, about having an American victory there. But he also made clear, both in his public statements and some of his diplomatic exchanges, that he was looking for North Vietnam to negotiate a settlement where they would leave South Vietnam alone. And so the troops were put in, and then the military action was not necessarily seeking a military goal as much as it was seeking a political goal to see what we'll do to you if you force us to come in and fight. Therefore, it's better for us to negotiate a settlement. And if you look at wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly the same dimensions are there. None of these are quite about a military victory. We're not talking about an army landing on the beach at Normandy and sweeping through France and liberating Paris late in the summer of 1944. We're not talking about Marines coming on the beach at Iwo Jima and raising the flag on Mount Suribachi in February of 1945. There were no flag raisings in Vietnam. It was not about territory in a conventional sense, about gain and hold. There certainly were territories, there were physical places, geography that we wanted to control. But most of it was not about control as it was demonstrating that we would fight. And so we ended up in just a different sort of war where we weren't seeking a normal victory. We're trying to certainly kill as many of the enemy as we could to demonstrate to them what we would do. And we kept increasing the number of troops that we had over there, thinking that now we'll show them, now they will be willing to negotiate. We increased some of our air attacks, saying now they'll be willing to negotiate. And it wasn't going to happen in this way. For us to have truly, quote, won the war in Vietnam, we would have had to send in, you know, probably a couple million more troops. We would have had to capture territory and have people occupy and hold it. We'd have to have been willing to use our firepower in a far more devastating way than we were, where there would be tremendous numbers of civilian casualties. And we weren't prepared to go that far. And after the experience in Korea, there was always a great sensitivity. We got to make certain that we don't push this too far and provoke the Chinese, because in 1950 late in 1950 in November, when the Chinese had warned us not to approach the boundary of the Yalu River, and we had gone into North Korea, they finally sent a lot of their soldiers across, and it became a different war. Lyndon Johnson didn't want this to happen, and so there was this restraint. You know, in Vietnam, the rules of engagement were far stricter than they were in World War II. And it was a different sort of war. I mean, we were certainly fighting people in uniform, but we weren't fighting an army in the field. About 80% of the military actions in Vietnam were initiated by the enemy, and that's not that we were sitting back softly and being attacked. We were sending patrols out, basically inviting them to attack our patrols, and then when they did, we'd know where they were, and we'd hit them very hard with artillery and air power. And so this was part of our military plan. But these were small units. These were squads and platoons and not even regularly companies that went out. There were other than a few places at Dak To and Way and Hamburger Hill and Khe Sanh, there were not sustained battles in Vietnam. Most of the combat skirmishes were over in 10 or 15 minutes, because the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front, their allies in the South, the Viet Cong, as we called them, they knew that after 10 or 15 minutes they should break away, because they were going to get hit with our firepower. And so the real exceptions are these sustained battles that were fought. And so it was, let's go back out in the field again today. We'll walk over the same trail that we walked over yesterday. We'll be ambushed as we were yesterday, and we'll fight back as we did yesterday. And then we'll go back to base camp. It's just a different sort of war. And I really marvel at the kids that I interviewed that were out fighting it. And by the way, I really sought to interview people who were in infantry units, who were in combat units, Marines or Army infantry or paratroopers, because I just wanted to really tell the story of what it was to serve out in the combat zones of Vietnam. And it was a remarkably difficult experience with heat and monsoons and walking through rice paddies and up steep hills and dealing with humidity and having enemy and what they call spider holes popping up and shooting at them and having to go in these tunnels after them and punji sticks, these sharp sticks that were infected, that were sitting up along the trails that people would step and develop an infection. It was a place with tremendous variations in weather, much of it unpleasant, with snakes and insects and rats and just basic unpredictability, never quite knowing what was going to happen next. And it's a war unlike any others in which Americans have fought, really.
Did the people, so this is partly a generational question, partly, I guess, a media question. Did the people going to Vietnam know what to expect?
Not really. They early on, 1965, when the first combat troops went in, the basic story in the United States was about these heroic soldiers out fighting in the jungle on behalf of democracy. And this was the story. Within a year or two, as more Americans were being killed, as there was no clear resolution to the war, as we increased the number of troops, as the combat increased increasingly, there was a sense that the war was wrong, that it was ill-fated, that we shouldn't be there. And so the kids in Vietnam were no longer heroes, but there was a sense of sympathy by 67, 68, more of them sort of began to resist the idea of going, although most kids, you know, they said, Tim O'Brien tells a wonderful story about going up in the woods of Minnesota and trying to decide whether to cross over to Canada or not, and then he didn't. He's talking about a fictional character, but it's clearly very much based on his own experience and his own thinking at the time, and most of them still did go. And then by late 1969, when the story broke about My Lai and the massacre of Vietnamese civilians, all of the image shifted markedly from no longer heroes in the jungle, no longer poor kids who were being set off to fight a cruel and nasty war. Now they became the perpetrators of a cruel and nasty war. They became the psychotics out in the jungle, and it was just such a negative view. And then, you know, there clearly were the Cali psychotics in the jungle. By all means, they were there, but most of these kids who were serving out there were not that. But that increasingly became the image that they came home with.
What are the stereotypes of the experiences of soldiers in Vietnam has to deal with race and the supposed divisions and conflicts between blacks and whites? You have a pretty nuanced approach to this. Can you talk about your sense of how race relations worked in Vietnam?
Sure. I think in early on, there were more black casualties, 65, 66, disproportionate black casualties, and many of them were black professionals, you know, that were staying in the Army, and they'd volunteered to be out in infantry units, and those infantry units were often disproportionately black. And then there was a great outcry about this and about it reflecting a sort of racism on the part of the military. Probably, you know, there surely was a deep racism on the part of the military, but I'm not sure that was a major factor then. Then by 68, let's say, you know, when Dr. King was assassinated, and the tremendous racial tensions in this country, obviously they spread to Vietnam, and some of the base camps over there, some of the main bases really had sharp lines of demarcation of, you know, tents with soul music playing, and tents with country music playing, tents with black flower salutes and black power salutes, and tents with Confederate flags. And there were a lot of fights on these bases between white and black. What I do point out is that, and again, my focus has been primarily on the combat experience in Vietnam, most people didn't carry that out into the field. The feeling has been true there, surely. I'm not suggesting that somebody suddenly ceased to be a racist. But most of the kids, black as well as white, said that, you know, that when you got to trust everybody when you're on a patrol in a combat area. You've got to depend on everybody. And as one black soldier said, nobody's going to call me a racist name when I'm walking around with a loaded automatic weapon. And it was just a different environment. Now, when they would come back to the base camps at night, they may well have gone separated back into black and white and partied or drank beer or smoked dope with people that were of their racial group. But it didn't carry out into the field in the way that so many people thought it did.
Another place you complicate our, I think, typical understanding of the war is the experience of veterans as they return home. And And I'll talk a little bit about the longer term experience of veterans, but maybe you can talk a little bit about that first month or two or even weeks after they return. Is there some way to, how did veterans, to what extent is the stereotypes that veterans were welcomed home on and viewed unpopularly, to what extent does that actually say something important about the experience of veterans coming home?
Well, I don't think that they were welcomed home in most cases. Now, you've got to remember the Vietnam War, different from World War II, where basically people didn't come home until the war was over, and different from Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have deployed to those areas forces in units. They go with their own battalion, and they come back with their own battalion, and so they come back to a base, and you've got several hundred people coming in together. Vietnam was a place where individuals were served for 12 months. Marines had 13 months. They went over individually. They flew over in charter planes, typically. Went into one of the major bases, were assigned to a unit, went through some orientation, and were sent out into the field. And then after their tour was up, they came back to one of the bases, had a day or two, not very long, some sort of debriefing of weapons check, and they got on planes and they flew home. And so they came with a group, but they may not have known anybody else on their plane. And all of us, somebody could be out in the jungle on patrol and dealing with a firefight, maybe watching a friend be killed one day, and 3 days later, he's on a plane flying to the Bay Area or Southern California or Seattle. When they got off the planes, and many of them got off at public airports, there were some hostile encounters. There were examples, certainly, of people spitting on them. I think the number of these, and most people think, were greatly exaggerated, part of it for political reasons. But if they were not greeted with hostility, they were not greeted with warmth. They talked to me about coming home, maybe getting a private commercial airline flight from Los Angeles to Kansas City, and getting off the plane and being met by their family and going home. And the thing that so many of them talked about is that there was a sense of welcome home, we're glad to have you here, on the part of family or friends, but nobody wanted to ask them about Vietnam. Nobody wanted them to talk about that experience. And most of these kids that served over there were not eager to come home and talk about combat experiences. I don't know of anyone who served in World War II or Iraq or Afghanistan who's necessarily eager to come home and talk about these experiences to people, to civilians, to family. But nobody asked them. They just went on with their lives, and it was hard to go on with their lives. And then by the early 70s, certainly after My Lai, there was this stereotyped image of them being a bunch of psychotics. You got to be careful with Vietnam veterans. Mm. The movie Taxi Driver became sort of a Hollywood's version of this stereotype. And I had enough accounts of people who had to deal with that. But most of them, it was not encountering the direct hostility. It was encountering some fear and suspicion, but most of all, it was just people were a bit embarrassed and didn't want to ask them about Vietnam, and so they never talked about it. One Marine said, "Well, at least when I go home, I can talk to my dad. He was in Iwo Jima, and he said, my dad never did ask me what it was like. He just didn't think I wanted to talk about it." And he clearly wasn't sure what sort of, that he wanted to hear my answer, because there was this image of a difficult, nasty war with heavy civilian casualties, and we don't want to hear about this. And so I think the generation, you know, there was no recognition of post-traumatic stress as being a medical or a clinical disorder at that time. It wasn't until the late 70s that it was recognized medically as a condition. In the early 70s, they talked about these kids who seemed to display some symptoms of withdrawal, of difficulty re-entering society, as suffering from what was the Vietnam syndrome. Well, it wasn't the Vietnam syndrome, but it was a way that time of again talking about just how unique this war was. Your World War II veteran said to them, "For God's sake, get over it." We did. Of course, they didn't. The World War II veterans that came back with some sort of post-traumatic stress had as much difficulty getting over it as the Vietnam generation. But we're talking about something that's as old as Odysseus, as old as the Trojan Wars. I mean, you know, that Shakespeare in the Civil War, they called it soldier's heart. And, you know, it was shell shock. It was battle fatigue. It was all sorts of names, but it was the same symptom. And so there was no such thing as, quote, the Vietnam syndrome. And it took a while for this to be recognized. And finally, when it was, it did provide means of help to the Veterans Administration. But people had to seek out the help, and there was still an unwillingness, certainly at that time, and today we still have some of it, of people unwilling to say, you know, I really feel kind of messed up, I can't sleep, I get angry, I get depressed, I get scared, what's wrong with me? People don't like to say those things, and they surely didn't then, so... The Vietnam generation had to suck it up and move on, and that was a difficult thing to do.
So I know our time is drawing to a close. I just have a couple last questions. One is, I'm wondering if the generational lens you adopt for this book, does that speak to us about America's experiences with war in the 21st century?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that the experience of war is generational. I mean, there were, you know, people who were born in the late teens and 20s or those that fought in World War II. My point is we need to tell the story of this generation, but it's something. It's a story that we all need to understand. We simply cannot say, "Well, this is their tale," and it's more than that. It's more than saying this is the type of music they liked in the 30s or music in the 60s. We're talking about something that they experience on our behalf, and my point is that we all have to understand what this experience is. It's too easy to send little boots marching off to the ground if you don't really know what it is you're asking kids to do, and so I think it becomes something for all of us to know about. So I'm telling a story, but my audience in some ways is the baby boomer Vietnam generation, but it's far, far broader than that.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and there's way more in the book than we've had a chance to talk about in this interview, so I strongly recommend to the listeners to run to Amazon or your local bookseller and pick it up and read it, because it's got a lot of good stuff in it. I always close with the same last question, Jim, and that is... recognizing that you have probably heard and read an enormous amount of important, moving, significant material. We're taping this in mid-April, and finals week is a couple weeks away, which in theory means I have a weekend where I can read something before I start grading papers. What is a book, or I suppose a movie, that you can suggest that, that you read in the course of this research that that you found important for you, that, that you would recommend to myself and the listeners?
Oh, boy. I mean, there are some wonderful historians of the Vietnam War, of the military war, you know, people like Greg Daddis and James Wilbanks and Kyle Longley. But I have to say, and I think I talk about this a little bit in the introduction to my book, Kelly, the people that I kept turning back to were some of the fiction writers, but the Vietnam veterans, men who had served in Vietnam in combat, who wrote about it, the Tim O'Briens and the Jim Webbs and the Carl Marlantes, because the, these books are just such powerful stories, you know, the things they carried by O'Brien, Fields of Fire by Webb, Matterhorn, a wonderful book by Carl Marlantes, that really gets you in and forces you to confront and understand the nature of the experience in Vietnam. And I guess I was trying as a historian, as a more scholarly writer, perhaps, although I would hate to say I'm more scholarly than any of those three that I just mentioned, that I was trying to tell that story as well. What was it like to serve in Vietnam? I went to Vietnam and part of the research for this book, and I walked the fields where many of these kids had fought, fields that people had talked to me about. I saw a lot of the sites. I climbed up Hamburger Hill, which is a site of one of the great battles of the war, and it allowed me sort of to experience what these people were talking about. In terms of geography, not experience, and in terms of obviously being in a military situation there. And it was this that I was trying to capture. So I would suggest that you make sure you've read Marlantes and Webb and O'Brien, and movies are harder. You know, I always turn back to something like The Deer Hunter, and I think it's just a powerful movie. I think it's not always so accurate, obviously, as depiction of the Vietnamese. And I make reference to, ironically, Apocalypse Now, which I think is a powerful movie. But I have said that Apocalypse Now tells you as much about the reality of the Vietnam War as South Pacific tells you about World War II. It's kind of a fairy tale about the war. These psychotics out there who were in the jungle. But it's certainly a powerful movie.
Well, I assign Marlantes go ahead.
And then go always to Good Morning Vietnam. You know, I interviewed for this book Pat Sajak, the television game show host, and Pat Sajak was a disc jockey in Saigon, and it was a wonderful story by Sajak and his experience there. But you know, Robin Williams, Good Morning Vietnam, everybody should see that.
I've seen that, although it's been years, and I assigned both O'Brien and Marlantes this semester in a class. But I will track Webb down. I have not read it, and I will do that. But thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being with us. Are you working on another book?
No, I'm working on some lectures and some op-ed pieces and some shorter pieces, but I don't think I'll take on another book-length project. But I've said that before, and I've written a couple books after saying it, but this time I think I probably do mean it, but who knows what I'll do.
Well, if you should turn out to be wrong, we'd love to have you back on the show, but for now, thanks so much for being with us.
It'll be my privilege, and thank you for a wonderful conversation, Kelly.
All right, bye-bye, Jim.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with James Wright about his new book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage for New Books in History, part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. Thanks for the download, and have a great month.